This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, where does the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois rank nationally when it comes to corruption? A new report paints a bleak picture. It's not just commercial newspapers struggling these days. High school newspapers are also having difficulty surviving. We'll visit some schools still making an effort to get the news out. College students, some of them first-time voters, are paying attention as the primary election nears, and they have questions for candidates.
I just want to know what their opinion of our youth is, just my general generation, such as Generation Z. It would be interesting to know what, especially the Democratic candidates who are significantly older than us, how they view us as the youth of America.
And our Illinois school districts following a relatively new law? We'll check that out. All of those stories and more this hour on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, the struggles faced by community newspapers is also showing up at high schools. We'll visit some schools trying to buck the trend. Our education reporter is joined by some high school journalists to find out if districts are complying with a new state law. And is Chicago the most corrupt city in the country? A new report from the University of Illinois Chicago says yes. That and more coming up on Statewide. This past year was the first time many farmers have grown hemp, now that it's legal under the 2018 Farm Bill. In addition to the normal challenges of farming, hemp growers have had to deal with a different kind of problem, theft. Harvest Public Media's Dana Cronin reports on a hemp heist here in Illinois.
DeMarcus Medley's four-acre farm sits on a busy street in Galesburg, Illinois. His is a small boutique-style farm, and he welcomes me into his greenhouse, where he grows food using aquaponics, a system where fish provide the nutrients to grow food.
These are our fish tanks. We raise goldfish and koi fish right now.
He grows mostly leafy greens and lettuces, but this year for the first time, he grew hemp.
Well, this is where we planted the hemp.
Just outside the greenhouse, he points to a snow-covered, desolate patch of what looks like twigs sticking out of the ground. Although it was his first year, Medley says the hemp growing was going pretty well, with the exception of a few bugs.
Yeah, as soon as we put it in the ground, it was just like, it just grew like crazy.
But as the hemp crop got closer to harvesting, Medley and his farmhand, Steve Sperry, started to notice some of the plants were disappearing.
We thought it was a deer at first, because they were just taking tops.
Yeah.
They were losing so much crop that they finally decided to install a camera. The footage showed people, not deer, sneaking onto the property in the middle of the night and stealing the plants.
So if you look, it's a path, and my neighbor's gate goes right there, and they were coming in from there, definitely.
Medley's best guess? The thieves thought they were stealing marijuana, hemp's cousin plant.
You know, even if it is hemp, whoever took it probably thought that they could get high or they could make some money off it.
Medley and Sperry had to call an emergency harvest. In the course of 24 hours, they did what normally would have taken days.
It was just kind of like, we got to get it done or somebody's going to steal it. Because they're definitely going to come back to get some more.
According to the police report, they lost about $25,000 worth of hemp.
It's unfortunate. I hate to see it. In the saddest part, or the most ridiculous part maybe, is that people are typically stealing this because they think it's marijuana, and it's not.
Jeff Cox is the Bureau Chief of Medicinal Plants at the Illinois Department of Agriculture. He says his department doesn't know how much hemp has been stolen this year. They don't keep track of it. But he says they have received a lot of calls about it. His best solution so far? Better signage.
We can put signs up to say this is industrial hemp, this is not marijuana.
Cox says the Department of Agriculture is also working on getting local law enforcement involved.
Russ Idle, I'm the Chief of Police for the Galesburg Police Department.
Idle's department handled DeMarcus Medley's case. He says they investigated a few suspects, but weren't able to find any concrete evidence.
At this point, our best guess is most likely, since the product really is unusable as a drug, it was probably, once they figured it out, they just got rid of it.
He says while this is the first case of hemp theft his station has had to deal with, they're starting to ramp up patrols.
We're aware of where the different hemp farms are, and we'll be wanting to kind of keep an eye on them and be on the lookout for people that don't look like they belong.
Is that something that you do for other farms?
Not really, but again, I think that this particular crop has a potential for theft or damage that maybe others don't.
DeMarcus Medley says he appreciates these efforts, but he says it should be up to hemp farmers to protect their own crop.
You're going to have to secure it, and you're going to probably have to accept loss if you don't.
Medley does plan to grow hemp again this year, but with added security, including motion sensor lights, fences, and cameras. And if that's not enough, he says his two Rottweilers should do the trick. Dana Cronin, Harvest Public Media.
According to the Illinois State Police, opioid overdoses are declining, but they're also reporting an uptick in the use of methamphetamine. Olivia Mitchell has more details.
In the past, meth was homemade, so the state restricted access to some of the ingredients like Sudafed. But now drug cartels are smuggling the drug into the U.S. State Police Major Troy Phillips says his task force has seen a significant increase in the amount of meth on the streets.
At the time we were purchasing grams and ounces, now it's very routine by our task forces that they're purchasing pounds, interdicting pounds of methamphetamine coming into Illinois.
Phillips also says price is driving people toward methamphetamine, which is cheaper than heroin. Although opioid overdoses are declining overall, they're on the rise in Black and Latino communities. I'm Olivia Mitchell.
Over the last two decades, newspapers across the country have struggled to stay afloat amid rapid changes in the digital news landscape. And they're not the only ones. High school newspapers have also quietly seen a decline. Adriana Cardona-Magiga of member station WBEZ takes us to some schools in Chicago where students and teachers are trying to keep the written word alive.
Have an idea right now that they're excited to share.
On a recent afternoon, senior student Will Foster leads an editorial meeting at Peyton College Prep on the near north side. 30 students are sitting in the classroom throwing around article ideas for the next issue of Paw Print, Peyton's newspaper.
I might do something about the coronavirus, but like use that as an angle to talk more about this flu season and how like it's been so deadly.
Another student wants to do an article about the new dean of students, or
someone can write something about like a March Madness article, because like when it is March Madness, every single person is watching the games on their computers during classes and like.
Michelle Duenas-Maury, an English teacher and journalism advisor at Peyton, has worked with students since 2011 to publish at least five times a year. The student journalists take her newspaper elective classes. She says they are highly popular.
Because kids really like to see themselves in print.
Duenas-Maury was a journalist before. She's deeply passionate about giving teens a voice and hands-on experience.
Our students designed our logo and our header. Everything's designed by students.
But few students get this opportunity. Peyton High School is one of the few schools in CPS with a strong newspaper and a commitment to printing 1,200 copies every time an issue comes out.
Definitely print newspaper has been on the decline, mostly because of budgets.
Duenas-Maury is also the vice president of the Scholastic Press Association of Chicago, an organization that supports high school journalism. She has been with the group for 10 years. She says a big problem in CPS is that the journalism classes where students learn to write and put together a newspaper tend to be electives, and
schools tend to cut electives. If we were to have a budget crisis again, and we didn't have any outside money to help us because our parents' organization does help us a lot at Peyton, we would have to cut all of our electives and just have core classes. So there would be maybe a newspaper club, but it would be only an online newspaper.
At Peyton, students prefer the print newspaper over an online publication, she says. And the students also take on controversial topics. One of the most difficult articles was about two teachers who were removed in 2018 from the school because of allegations of inappropriate behavior.
The headline here is allegations removed two teachers, changed Peyton, moves onward.
Will Foster, the student leading the editorial meeting, wrote the story. He was a junior at the time.
I wanted to explain as best as I could the situation. What had the culture of the school changed at all? I talked to students, like, how did they feel? Did they still feel safe? Just sort of the sensitivity of the topic was really difficult for me, but I felt like it really helped me grow as a journalist.
Will is the type of kid who's been reading the Chicago Tribune since he was in fourth grade. His passion for print journalism dates back to middle school, where he was also the editor of his school paper. Mimi Hamara also writes for Paw Print.
Definitely become a more critical thinker, and also I definitely think I've become more confident when it comes to talking to adults.
That's the type of meaningful experience Ryan Kugnia wishes his students still had at Mather High School on the north side. Kugnia is an English teacher there. He remembers when his school used to have a thriving newspaper, the Mather Free Press.
The students who were writing some of these articles that were super popular slash controversial, they realized the power of the pen in that they realized their words mattered.
Kugnia taught journalism and helped run the Mather Free Press for 8 years. Students wrote about gender inequality within the school, LGBTQ issues, and other topics important to students.
That was in the glory days of when we had a bigger school, we had the full funding, the newspaper was coming out monthly.
But as enrollment dropped, so did the budget. Kugnia says the high school newspaper was one of the programs to first see cuts. The school got rid of one of the journalism electives, then cut the funding to print the paper. The school then switched to an online publication as a solution, but that didn't take off. Eventually, the Mather Free Press stopped publishing.
For whatever reason, the online newspaper at Mather just never got people excited. There was something about the visuals of print, being able to hold the newspaper, the kids seeing their friends reading articles about them and the awards they had won. There was something about the print newspaper that I think was magical that is really sad, that has faded. I didn't realize how cool it was until we didn't have it anymore.
While some schools have lost their newspaper altogether, Curie High School on the southwest side is willing to try something new to bring back the school paper.
Do we want to use this font for all the titles and all the pages?
Starting next year, Curie is offering journalism as a 4-year concentration and not just as an elective. Curie has had a newspaper off and on over the years, but it was hard to recruit students to stay with the program for more than a year. Teachers also notice a loss of student interest in writing. Umbren Kadir is the English teacher there.
The other challenge has been that their graduation requirements compete with their elective classes. So instead of having journalism compete with a graduation requirement, why not make it a graduation requirement?
She hopes that as her school commits the funds and the academic support, her students will discover the power of the press and maybe even consider becoming part of the next generation of journalists. Adriana Cardona Magigad, WBEZ News.
You're listening to Statewide. In 2017, Illinois became one of the first states in the nation to require free feminine hygiene products inside school bathrooms. But are districts complying with the law? To check it out, our education reporter Dusty Rhodes partnered with a couple of high school journalists.
Imagine this. You've got 5 minutes to get from language arts to algebra, just enough time to pop into the ladies' room. And surprise, your menstrual period has arrived a few days early. With no supplies in your purse, you panic. But wait, there on the wall,
there is a dispenser.
So problem solved, right?
But one side of it is broken and the other side is empty.
That's Lainey Romaker. She's a junior at Springfield Southeast High School and one of two journalism students who helped report this story. Since there's no handy way to do a scientific survey, they used their network of friends to help collect anecdotal evidence of this new law's implementation, or lack thereof.
Mostly I found that in other schools, there was the same situation as we have. They have dispensers, but either the kids don't know they're there, or if they are there, they're not fully equipped with what should be in them.
Under the Learn with Dignity Act, tampons and sanitary pads are supposed to be available for free in school bathrooms. Abigail Olulari, another journalism student at Southeast, discovered most students had never heard of this law.
But there's many people who I told about the law were in the dark like me, but more so, the views on it were positive, and they're like, yeah, this is the thing. Like, okay, doing it.
Letisa Wallace sponsored the legislation. Back then, she was the Democratic state representative for Rockford, and this issue had long been one of her personal crusades.
I had an annual holiday party that I would do in my district, and to attend the party, I asked people to bring feminine hygiene products in diapers to go to our local shelters and a crisis nursery in my district.
As her bill wound its way through committees, a few lobbyists tried to derail it. Allison Maley with the Statewide School Management Alliance explains why.
A lot of times what it comes down to is whether or not there is funding associated with a mandate that's coming from the state that they are not necessarily supporting financially. So that's really where our opposition came in.
Yet no one ever requested a dollar figure, Wallace says.
There were no cost estimates done on the bill, which was very surprising. Usually opponents will try to get that to stall something.
Perhaps that's because in the summer of 2017, state lawmakers were worrying about a budget stalemate, overhauling school funding, and ramping up protections for abortion rights. In the midst of that debate, Wallace saw her opportunity.
After the hours-long debate on reproductive health, I went to the clerk and asked that he please put the bill on the board, and I believe it passed in less than 2 minutes.
Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This is a bill that simply states that in our education facilities, public, private, or charter, we will provide in the restroom feminine hygiene products for girls in school.
Please take the record on this question. There are 64 voting yes, 51 voting no, and this bill, having received a constitutional majority, is hereby declared passed.
2 months later, then-Governor Bruce Rauner signed it into law. But the Learning with Dignity Act doesn't have any teeth, so Abigail questioned Maley about whether districts are actually obeying the law.
Is there any work going on to see if it could be enforced or to get funding for this?
As far as I know, and I haven't done a study or a survey of any sort, as far as I know, schools are complying with this as best they can.
In our non-scientific social media survey, the most common response indicated many districts provide free products only in the school nurse's office, which isn't what Wallace's legislation requires.
The law is very clear that the products are to be provided within the bathroom. Just like we provide toilet tissue and soap and paper towels, those products should be inside the restroom.
After weeks of research, the student journalists agreed we had only one solid conclusion. The situation would be different if boys needed these products.
Like, if guys needed it, it would be no problem.
Reporting with Abigail Olulari and Lainey Romaker, I'm Dusty Rhodes.
There's more to come on Statewide. Students weigh in on issues in this election season. That and more on the way. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, waiting for a kidney can be a matter of life and death. Some have gone to unusual methods to find a donor. Also, we'll hear what some college students think of the issues this election year. That and more still ahead. In 2020, you're the boss at the ballot box. This year, we'll be listening as you share what issues are important to you and what you want candidates to know about your community. Many college students are joining the electoral process as the 2020 elections approach. Chase Kavanaugh has more on how a Northern Illinois community college both registers and educates new voters.
Kishwaukee College in Malta has many students who have or will reach voting age. But education instructor Cynthia DeSef says some of the students had misconceptions.
A while back I was doing voter registration here at the college, and some students were saying how they don't vote, they don't ever vote, their vote doesn't count. And I thought, no, this is not okay, no, this is a college, we can do better than that.
The college launched a series of events called Let's Vote. DeSef says the first goal is closing the information gap.
Voting is actually a simple task, but there are lots of components to your ballot that people might not understand. I don't know what that job is. I don't know who those people are. I don't understand the issues. I don't know what to vote for.
Student body president Albert Warnar says the other is localizing races for each student.
So we're local as in we're west of Chicago, but within that there's many places. So things to consider are where to vote. That's a big question, especially around here, because people are in different counties, they don't vote in the same place.
Voter registration is handled by volunteers from within the college and groups such as the League of Women Voters. Patricia Verry with the League says the process goes smoothly for the most part.
A lot of them have come here or staying in a different place than their home, so sometimes their driver's license is their home address, and we have to make sure that we know where they are now. and get that on the registration.
After registration comes voter education. Above all, Warnar says it needed to be nonpartisan.
The issues on our information form are specifically alphabetical, not at all related to issue importance.
Instead of bringing in advocates from parties or interest groups, educators from the college sit down with individual students and guide them to different resources. DeSef says they make use of three websites in particular.
Civics 2.0 teaches about government and voting. Vote411.org is a League of Women Voters website. If you give it your address, it will tell you your voting precinct and your voting districts. And VoteSmart.org is a wonderful website with just a database full of information about all kinds of candidates.
Warnar says these databases also help localize a student's local races.
We have the different websites for the different counties, and the volunteers will run them through the website and say, okay, in your county, these are your candidates, and each candidate usually has a website.
Overall, response to this approach has been positive among students. Cassandra Kurzak is from Illinois near St. Louis.
It went really well. It was easy. It was, it made sense. It was very straightforward. I had all the information on me. I didn't have to bring in anything that wasn't already in my wallet or anything. It was wonderful.
Issues remain varied among the student body. For Kurzak, these include human rights and the environment.
Mother Earth could wipe us from the face of the planet if she wanted, and we just need to correct what's going on to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Another student, Cameron Pratt of the Indianapolis area, is concerned about U.S. military action.
Whether we might happen to be launching a war effort that may or may not be necessary or anything like that, and just making the right decision overall on that situation, because, you know, war costs money and we don't have it.
The first Let's Vote campaign had volunteers completely occupied within the first half hour. Kishwaukee College will hold more of these events once per week on different days for the entire month of February. DeSef, Warnar, and the other organizers hope it can both inform more students and bring them further into the democratic process. I'm Chase Cavanaugh.
With the Illinois primary election drawing closer, college students are preparing to cast their votes, some for the first time. We asked several Northern Illinois University voters at campus voter registration events about the most important issues in the election and what questions they would ask candidates and current office holders directly if they had the chance. Here's what they had to say.
Hi, my name is Salvador Meza. I'm an electrical and computer engineering major, and I'm from Chicago, Illinois. Well, on a national level, definitely there seems to be a lot of division within the country. It'd be nice to have a candidate that can unite both sides, kind of see both sides of the matter. That would be probably like the primary thing. Definitely immigration. Right now, immigration is a big deal for me, at least. On the state level, definitely taxes. Probably taxes need to get a little bit sorted out. I'd definitely ask them what would be their plan for immigration, for not only the DACA students, but for the other 12 million immigrants who have been here 10 plus, 20 plus years, raising their families. You know, what are they going to do about them? Are they just going to help the DACA students and help people who have spent a good portion of their lives here raising their kids, seeing them to get a better future? Are they just going to be left behind, or is there going to be some immigration reform for them?
My name is Lexi Schumann. I'm studying psychology at Northern Illinois University, and I'm from Lake Zurich, Illinois. Overall job and economy issues, making sure that there are enough jobs for everybody, as well as the issue of minimum wage to make it at least $15 an hour, and as well as gun control is more of a personal issue for me, as well as being a student. I just want to know what their opinion of our youth is, just my general generation, such as Generation Z. My sister, she just turned 18, so her whole graduating class is about to start voting. They don't understand a lot what goes into the election process, so it'd be interesting to know what, especially the Democratic candidates who are significantly older than us, how they view us as the youth of America.
My name is Dahlia Roscoe. I am a history major, secondary education major, and I'm from Elgin, Illinois. Immigration, gun laws, yeah, education.
My name is Jeremy Jordan. I'm a first-year law student here at Northern Illinois University College of Law. My hometown is Waukegan, Illinois, northern part of the state, right under Wisconsin. Well, the national level, definitely my main issue is the environment. Huge supporter of the Green New Deal, huge supporter of the candidates who are, you know, extremely progressive, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren. At the state level, mainly J.B. Pritzker, following through on a lot of his campaign promises. He's been very great so far since he's been in office, and hopefully he just keeps it up. Hopefully, if I could sit down with J.B. Pritzker, I would really want to know how his environmental plans are going to be playing out, you know, hopefully after he's out of office. I don't want him to put something in, get something passed through the House and sign a bill that's just going to be overturned by, say, like a pro-business governor or pro-business legislature.
I'm Kima Estes. I'm from Chicago Heights, Illinois, and I am undecided, but I want to be a physician assistant. I feel like an adult now because at first I couldn't vote because my birthday was late, so now I think I'm ready, honestly. What do they plan to do with college tuition as far as lowering it, helping us pay for it?
My name is Luke Carlson. I'm studying law at the law school here at NIU, and I'm from Rockford, Illinois. Well, Illinois specifically, it's probably the pension problem, pension crisis. I don't know if you call it a crisis, but yeah, the ongoing pension problem. Nationally, I don't know, it's complicated. So a local candidate, I'd probably be asking, well, local and state would be specifically about pensions, just because that is, you know, it's like a hydra that's slowly eating up every budget in Illinois. So, and just growing and growing, and it pretty much will require a constitutional amendment to fix it. So knowing where they stand on that would be pretty informative.
Those are the voices of students at Northern Illinois University talking about issues important to them during the 2020 election year. Teachers from Uruguay on Fulbright Scholarship are in Northern Illinois learning from local bilingual educators. Peter Medlin with member station WNIJ has more on the cultural exchange inside and outside the classroom.
Samuel Costa is the only teacher at a small school in rural Uruguay close to the border of Brazil. His 11 students range in age from kindergarten all the way to sixth grade. And he's not just the only teacher, he's the only adult, period. So he has to clean and be a chef. Samuel makes his class a home-cooked breakfast and lunch every day. And that's on top of meeting the typical academic standards.
To learn about what he does, like, I cannot complain about my job.
That's Megan Forty. She's a bilingual third grade teacher at Little John Elementary in DeKalb. Samuel has been shadowing her in her class, and she has also been hosting him at her house for the past few weeks. There are 21 Uruguayan teachers spread across the DeKalb and Elgin school districts. They're learning bilingual ed best practices, but they don't all just teach English. They teach across content areas from math and science to sign language. Some, like Samuel, teach in a rural school, while others teach in the capital city of Montevideo. James Cohen is an associate professor of ESL bilingual education at Northern Illinois University.
So we have the whole gamut, and to see them intermingling, the exchange is just tremendous.
Cohen helped facilitate getting the Fulbright teachers up to Illinois. He was a Fulbright scholar in Uruguay just last year. The Uruguayans are in Illinois for about a month. When they landed in Chicago, it was snowing. Selene Aria is one of the Uruguayan elementary school teachers.
For many of us, it has been the very first time we saw snow, so we were very excited about it.
Aria and the other teachers spent about a week in Chicago before their shadowing commenced. They got to see a Chicago Bulls game and visit some of the city's museums. Aria says the amount of choice at stores and restaurants in the U.S. is notable, and that prices for some teaching material are significantly lower in the U.S. than in Uruguay. Another of the teachers, Patricia Betancourt, agreed. She says an English hardcover that costs $7 in Illinois could be $70 or $80 in Uruguay. So the teachers have been stocking up. Emily Quaid is a Little John teacher and former Fulbright scholar herself. She also helped with some of the translation for this story.
When they show up at a bookstore, they're like, oh, here comes Selene, careful.
Betancourt says even though the resources and equipment might be different, the challenges that persist in education are the same for them in Uruguay as they are in DeKalb. And she says during her shadowing, conversations about finding solutions to global issues, balancing class resources or supporting special needs students, help the teachers bond. James Cohen says the Uruguayan teachers are also presenting in their classrooms and going to educational presentations at NIU.
I've never seen a group of people with such passion for knowledge.
There are some differences between the two nations' education systems. Cohen, who was in Uruguay last year, says the way foreign language is taught is very different. He says some programs send instructional videos and lessons to smaller rural schools where teachers don't even speak that language.
Elementary school teachers who don't speak any English are teaching kids how to speak English, and they're learning English alongside the kids. The power dynamics have completely shifted.
Back at Little John, Megan Forty says it didn't take long for the students and Samuel to get comfortable, even though he doesn't speak any English.
The kids immediately, you know, gave him that respect, which you have to earn. So within a week, they were saying, Maestro, teacher, don't go.
The teachers were to go back to Uruguay after a final ceremony on February 22nd. Cohen and the other teachers said they were expecting lots of tears as they left their friends and host families.
The most meaningful thing that I took from this experience is people.
Selene Adia says their passion for students easily bridged that perceived gap.
I feel that I was very welcome here, and it was, for me, priceless.
It's likely that Forty and the other host teachers would say the same. I'm Peter Medlin.
Across the country, nearly 95,000 people are waiting for a kidney transplant, and the list has been growing for years. That's pushed some people to try unusual ways to find donors. Natalie Krebs with Side Effects Public Media explains.
Larry Burkholder is 72 and has chronic kidney disease. The Iowa man was put on the list for a new kidney last March, but was told the average wait is a long one.
Well, they say usually it's typically 3.5 years or so. 3.5 to 5, I think.
Burkholder turned to Facebook to see if he could find someone to donate a kidney, but no one stepped up.
Well, a lot of support and prayers, but not a whole lot. Nobody really said, wow, I'll give one, you know.
Then Burkholder had another idea. He put a big custom vinyl sticker on the back window of his blue Hyundai Sonata.
It says, Larry needs a kidney! Exclamation mark. Any blood type, and then my phone number.
Stickers are also on the cars of his wife, daughter, and a friend. Burkholder says so far he's gotten a few calls, but none has worked out.
One person wanted me to violate a federal law and wanted to know how much money I'd give him for a kidney because they were in financial trouble. I told him that's a federal law. Can't do that. So
nationally, about 80% in line for an organ transplant are waiting for a kidney. Alan Reed is the director of the transplant program at the University of Iowa. He says an increasing number of people have medical conditions that cause kidney failure.
And so the largest percentage of people being added to the list have diabetes and high blood pressure.
As baby boomers age, more older patients are being added to the list. And he says all these factors have created a simple problem of supply and demand. More than 3,800 people died last year waiting for a kidney, including 18 in Iowa, where Larry Burkholder lives.
We're not growing the available kidneys to transplant as quickly as there is a need.
The number of kidneys from deceased donors has rapidly increased in the past few years, due in part to the opioid epidemic. But the number of living donors has remained flat for years, and there still aren't enough kidneys to meet the growing demand overall. Reed says to get a kidney faster, he encourages his patients to reach out to their community. Still, there aren't many incentives for donors.
They may have to be out of work for a period of time. They may have to travel and need food and lodging. There's actually ways you can get compensated for that, but they don't necessarily get compensated for all the risk that they take.
Reed says he'd like to change that because there are economic and medical benefits for patients to have a living donor.
That kidney will work better, will work faster, will get you out of the hospital sooner, and will cost society substantially less. You may not have to go on dialysis, you may not need dialysis access, and will last you longer than any deceased donor kidney.
Des Moines resident Sandy Feierstein looked for a donor on Facebook because she has a rare blood type.
With my blood type, they told me it could be 3 to 5 years, which also means I could eventually go on dialysis to try to save my life before a kidney becomes available.
The 62-year-old has Buerger's disease, which keeps her kidneys from filtering blood properly. She was put on the list last April. Firesign's Facebook post was shared more than 90 times. It caught the eye of Lynn Susick, who lives in a Des Moines suburb. She volunteered, saying she's always wanted to donate.
I just think that we should give back however we can. So to me, whether it was someone I knew or someone I don't know, Sandy, even though I've never met her, she's just as important to me.
Susick, who is 59, says she's not worried about living with only one kidney.
I have researched it, and there's no discernible difference for people that in terms of lifespan if you have one kidney or two.
Dusick also says missing weeks of work during recovery isn't an issue.
I'm very lucky that I am retired and don't need to worry about that.
Sandy Firestein's wait isn't over. Susick still needs to complete testing to see if she's a match before she can donate. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Natalie Krebs.
We have more ahead on Statewide, and be sure to follow us. Our weekly podcast is available through the NPR One app. And you can find all our episodes at statewideshow.com. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Thomas Gradle is the co-author of the book Corrupt in Illinois, Patronage, Cronyism, and Criminality. He and a team of researchers from the University of Illinois Chicago recently dug into statistics from an annual Department of Justice report and concluded that between 1976 and 2018, Chicago was the most corrupt city in the nation. Illinois was almost as bad, ending up third after the state of Louisiana and the District of Columbia. Our reporter Maureen McKinney talked with Gradle, a retired political consultant and journalist, about their findings, which were rounded out by information collected from the Cook County State's Attorney, Inspectors General, and local governments. They also considered news reports of corruption cases.
Why is there so much corruption in Chicago and Illinois as a whole?
I believe it's the culture, and I believe there are numerous factors for that culture. Chicago's political machine lasted longer than the political machines in most of the big cities, New York, Minneapolis, Detroit, Los Angeles. And that's primarily because the old Mayor Daley, Richard J. Daley, was really an expert at maintaining the machine, warding off trouble, keeping the people's attention on other things, and not allowing or not creating a situation where reformers, and especially in other big cities, reformers were backed by business community and religious communities who pushed for reform. That push never really materialized in Chicago. And I think Chicago's behavior was contagious and is copied by other locales in the state. Many of the convictions over the years also involved Republican and involved state government. So Chicago's behavior was learned, you know, exported. It was contagious, and it was copied by many other localities. We did a report, I don't know how many years ago it was now, on corruption in the suburbs in the Chicago metropolitan area. And there was quite a bit of it. When we started doing it, I didn't think there was going to be that much, but we discovered quite a bit. It's not only the longevity and the successful operation of the Cook County Democratic machine. Also, there are two other factors that I think are really important. One is the crime syndicate, the mob, or which is known in the Chicago area as the Outfit, very much mirrored, and there was a symbiotic relationship between organized crime and political. I could tell you a lot of stories about old Big Bill Thompson and Al Capone, and there was a lot of interplay between these two organizations. I don't have any evidence that they, you know, sat down and planned things together, or there was a signed agreement that they were going to stay out of each other's way. But the evidence suggests that is the case. The third factor that I think caused Chicago to be, the corruption to be so prevalent and persistent over the years, is I think that the racial situation in Chicago was such that the Democratic machine, especially led by the old Richard J. Daley, was seen as a bulwark against the emergence of African-American and the African-Americans' political power growth and also their business growth. And I think the white population, not everybody, of course, but the large amounts of the white population in Chicago was perfectly happy with whatever Richard J. Daley did as long as he was keeping the blacks down. Therefore, I think that discouraged people from going after Richard J. Daley on the corruption angles and gave him a lot of leeway well, he's doing good work. I can't prove that, but there's evidence that that's what happened and why it happened. I can't get into people's minds about what motivated them. And of course, people don't write about, they don't write down that, you know, I wanted to keep the blacks out of my neighborhood. I wanted to keep the blacks out of the electing politicians. And I think if you read what happened over time, I think that's a valid conclusion.
Let's talk about the most interesting cases in the city and the state in 2018.
The most interesting thing was the raid on Alderman Edward Burke's Finance Committee headquarters in City Hall, and also his ward office. That revealed that he had been under investigation for, I believe it was 2 years prior to that, and subsequently found out that Alderman Danny Solis had been investigated by the FBI and agreed to cooperate, wore a concealed recording device and recorded conversations with Alderman Burke over a long period of time, and possibly included information and activities about other politicians and other aides and campaign workers for other politicians. So the suggestion by the information that has come out and the search warrants and documents that have been filed, the suggestion is that the investigation is widespread, not only widespread across the surface, but deep down into political organizations. And we expect that there will be many more convictions in the next 2 or 3 years. The other investigations that involve State Senator Martin Sandoval, who has since pled guilty and is cooperating with the federal prosecutors, and also an investigation involving the Teamsters, business operations involving a movie studio in Chicago. There's an organization called Sinscape on the southwest side of Chicago. It got some state grants in order to develop. They bought in a lot of business. There's a lot of filming that takes place in Chicago that didn't previously, and much of it was done through that organization. They were paying off, many of their employees are members of the Teamsters. They were paying off John Coley, who was the head of the Teamsters council in Chicago, which involved more than just he was getting paid off by the movie studio. The head of the movie studio was investigated. He then implicated the Teamsters boss John Coley, who has since pled guilty but is cooperating with the federal investigators. He's important because he was the key Teamster involved in political endorsements in Illinois, and had endorsed Mayor Rahm Emanuel. He endorsed and worked with former Governor Pat Quinn, and he's also the one that hired State Senator Tom Cullerton for essentially a ghost job. He didn't have to do anything. In fact, their investigation showed that he did very little work, had almost no evidence of doing any work for the Teamsters, but got a couple $100,000 for not doing any work. These investigations are still ongoing. The expectations are that they will reveal a lot more corruption and other people will be indicted and prosecuted. These investigations are based on the documents that have been already made public, are very widespread. There's one investigation involved some policemen who were, working with drug sellers and drug dealers and planning the information and getting false search warrants, telling the judges that they got information that required this investigation to take place. And then they would do the investigation and they would steal some of the evidence, sell it or put it back on the street. Most of the previous cases of that were on a larger scale, but still, this is still going on. It still takes place. There's a whole culture in Chicago, in the police department, but especially in most of the government, that workers keep their head down, keep their nose out of other people's business, and don't rat on other people. So a lot of corruption that normally, you know, in a private business or other institutions would get dealt with, doesn't get dealt with in Chicago because of this code of silence.
You envision more convictions down the road?
Yes, I believe there will be quite a few. I mean, in the range of half a dozen to a dozen more people indicted. I mean, there are others that we didn't mention that have taken place. You know, the benefits he got has Solis and Sandoval involve numerous red light camera deals and bribery. The investigation may even go into the activities of Commonwealth Edison and how they have hired political operatives to be lobbyists and whether or not they were actually doing lobbying or whether or not those jobs were payoffs for activity that politicians and the political operatives did on behalf of Commonwealth Edison. All of these things are suggested by the documents that have already been filed, but they have yet to actually result in indictments or convictions. One of the things that you learn when you're studying these political crimes that are investigated by the federal government, they take a long time to pin down all of the aspects of the case. And part of that is the federal prosecutors do not like to lose cases. Their conviction rate is extremely high. So they don't really move on things and rush them to an end until they're sure they're going to get the conviction. And that they've tied down all the other loose ends. Other people involved are investigated, indicted, and convicted before they close on the bigger fish.
Do you have any ideas on what can be done?
There needs to be a more serious effort by, I think, the state government. One of the big things that comes up in all of these investigations is people abusing campaign funds and the prevalence of large contributions going into campaign funds and politicians building up large campaign funds, even though they don't need it for their next race or the one after that, and how they use that money to augment their political power, not just for the campaign that you know, is upcoming. I think the state ought to hire, first of all, the State Department that keeps the campaign financing records has very little investigative or prosecutorial powers. I think they ought to have a team of auditors, campaign financing reports. Seriously, go after people that abuse it, and you won't see these situations where there's been campaign financing abuse for year after year after year by the same politician. And nobody's done anything about it until the federal government catches up with them, and prosecutes them for something else. The other thing is inspector generals are really a good development that after the, you know, like in the last 10 years. But inspector generals have to have more power. Their reports have to be made public. The names of people that are investigated have to be disclosed. And they need to be independent of the people that they're investigating. And we don't see that. The state executive inspector general and the state legislative inspector general are not sufficiently independent. They're not as aggressive as they should be. Those offices need to be strengthened and funded properly. I think we have a pretty good inspector general in Chicago. It's been a long time developing. I mean, the first inspector generals that I read about didn't have that title, but there were inspectors under Mayor Richard J. Daley who did very little, and nobody knew much about what they were doing. And that over the years has that office has been strengthened. And I think that needs to be done in many locales. The other thing is, I think the Illinois Attorney General needs to be able to investigate any possible corruption involving state money. If there's state money given to a public school and there's corruption going on in that public school, if the local prosecutor is not doing something about it, the Illinois Attorney General ought to be able to investigate it because there's state money involved. The public needs to push more and more on having independent, and I mean politically independent, investigations and prosecutions. It's understandable that a local prosecutor, like a state's attorney, doesn't want to investigate members of his own political party, political associates that he has to rely on for his own election. but there's no reason why the Illinois Attorney General can't do the investigations. And when they can't do those investigations, the information would be turned over to the federal prosecutors, because you can't have politicians refusing to investigate people of their own political party or their own crony. And that has to stop.
That's Thomas Gradel, co-author of Corrupt in Illinois, Patronage, Cronyism, and Criminality. He and his co-author Dick Simpson, along with other UIC researchers, produced a 12th look at corruption in the state and its major city by analyzing statistics from a federal Department of Justice report. You can read that full report. A link is at our website at statewideshow.com. That wraps up this episode of Statewide. Thanks for joining us, and be with us again at this time next week. We're on the web and on Facebook. Just look for Statewide Show. Our podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.